The reading's on page 792 of the Bibles. Haggai chapter 2, starting at verse 20. The word of the Lord came a second time to Haggai on the 24th day of the month. Speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I am about to shake the heavens and the earth and to overthrow the throne of kingdoms. I am about to destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the nations and overthrow the chariots and their riders. And the horses and their riders shall go down, every one by the sword of his brother. On that day, declares the Lord of hosts, I will take you, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, declares the Lord, and make you like a signet ring, for I have chosen you, declares the Lord of hosts.
Well, thank you, Bryony, for reading. If I can add my welcome to Mark's, you should find in your service sheet a handout that you might find helpful for following on, especially if you're a note taker. And well, with all the other awful things going on in the news this week, you could be forgiven if you didn't notice that Monday was the day that plans for London Garden Bridge were formally abandoned. Originally, Joanna Lumley's idea was going to go between Waterloo Bridge and Blackfriars Bridge, measuring in at 30 metres wide and 366 metres long. They planned for it to be pedestrians only. And as the name suggests, and as you can see from these artist impressions, the main feature was to be a park with a footpath passing through the centre. Years in the planning, the project ran into trouble as serious questions started to be raised about how financially viable it was. Not only did they need to raise over £100 million of private money to build it, and even then only alongside generous public subsidy, but they also estimated that it would cost about £2 million a year to maintain. The project met with several hiccups along the way, but the real death blow was when the mayor, Sadiq Khan, withdrew his support from the project. Without his backing, indeed in the face of his opposition, there was no realistic chance they'd ever be able to finish the project. All in all, they reckon about £50 million worth of public money has been lost before the building project has even started. Now, I don't know what you thought of the Garden Bridge project as an idea. Some people thought that it was an exciting plan to add some much-needed green space into the heart of the city, and others said it was an expensive vanity project. If I'm honest, personally, I've not really looked into it enough to have a strong opinion on it. But everyone agrees that it was an ambitious project that's come to an embarrassing conclusion as it lost the support of the authorities. If you've not been with us the last few weeks, Haggai is a book about a building project. It's not mentioned in our reading today, but it's all Haggai's been talking about right from chapter 1. Haggai is a book about building God's temple. From the very start of the book up until this point, Haggai has been encouraging his readers to throw themselves wholeheartedly behind the work of building God's temple. He's claimed that a life dedicated to any other purpose is a wasted life. And so, week by week, he's been equipping us to deal with the difficulties and pitfalls we encounter as we go about building the temple. But if you're tempted to head straight to home base to pick up some cement so you can get involved yourself, we've also seen that living out Haggai's vision in our time looks very different to how it did back in 520 BC when he first wrote the book. Lots of Bible themes are like that. You start off with the Old Testament picture and you move through to a New Testament reality. And we've seen over the last couple of weeks that when the New Testament talks about God's temple, it's pointing us to his people, the church. God's building project now is building up his church, which means that for us, the unwasted life is the one wholeheartedly devoted to bringing non-Christians to know God and helping Christians know him better. And even if it's not directly mentioned in the reading, we're still looking at the topic of building God's temple in our passage this evening. Because the message Haggai's been sent to deliver is to the man who's responsible for overseeing the whole temple building project, Zerubbabel. Our passage calls him the governor of Judah, though if he'd wanted to be snobby, he could have reminded Haggai that his granddad had been the king. And he's the one that the Jews are looking to provide leadership and to make sure that the temple building project is brought to a successful conclusion. And given the timing of the message, 3 months after the building works first began, Zerubbabel might well have been having a few sleepless nights on that front. Plenty of people in the neighbouring provinces were far from pleased to see the rebuilding efforts going on. And many of them would have liked nothing more than to stop the temple building project dead in its tracks. In particular, if you look in Ezra chapter 5, he tells us that no sooner had the rebuilding works begun than Tattenai, who's the guy that's next up the chain of command from Zerubbabel, along with all the governors of all the neighbouring provinces, wrote a letter to the emperor himself. They were asking him to review the planning permission for the new temple. Rather threateningly, they'd also provided a list of the ringleaders, and Zerubbabel's name was sure to be top of the list. It was a strategy that had worked successfully before. In fact, when Zerubbabel had first tried to rebuild the temple, which was 16 years before Haggai came along, a letter to the emperor had been all it took to ensure that orders were given to stop immediately. Would it work again? And even if this particular scheme didn't work, Zerubbabel might well have asked if he was really going to be able to see this one through to completion. His opponents seemed so powerful and influential. He seemed so isolated and weak. Could he really hold out long term if they were determined to stop him? Now, there are obviously some differences between us and Zerubbabel. Speaking personally, I struggle to govern my rapidly thinning hair, let alone a whole nation. We're much more like the ordinary Jews in Haggai's day than their governor. But by listening in on what's said to Zerubbabel, we'll learn vital information that will keep us going as we serve the church. Because while we might not share Zerubbabel's position, there's a fair chance that we might share his anxieties. After all, there are plenty of people still around who would be far from pleased to see God's church being built today. And increasingly, it seems, they do seem to be the people who have power and influence over British society. You might remember not long ago, Tim Farron, who used to lead the Liberal Democrats, said that he didn't think it was possible for a consistent Christian to lead a major political party anymore. Now, whether you think he's right about that or not, it's hard to deny that as Christian values get ever further out of step with society's values, lots of people are worried that soon Christians will start to feel the heat. And what might seem like a slightly vague sense that things are going against us at the big picture level of society can translate into real roadblocks for our temple building in day-to-day life. So maybe as a teacher you wanted to start a CU at your school. You thought maybe it would help build God's temple because you could get alongside some of the Christian pupils and encourage them to reach out to their friends. The head teacher was not enthusiastic. She thought it would be bad for social cohesion. With such a diverse student body, you don't know who might get offended, she said. And besides, don't you think people would feel excluded? Or you get into the office on Tuesday morning and there's that email from the HR manager. You're called into his office because there've been some complaints. I'm asking you to tone down that Jesus chat, he says. You're making people uncomfortable. It's fine for you to be into that in your own time, but it's not acceptable for you to impose your views on other people. You're not sure exactly who complained or even quite what you did that upset them, but as you head back to your desk, you feel like you're treading on eggshells. Or perhaps you were trying to organise an event for your uni CU. It's been a nightmare trying to get the college admin to cooperate with getting a room booked. In the end, they did give you one, a shoebox in one of those out-of-the-way corridors nobody goes to. It was too late to put it on the flyer. Nobody came. It's probably not that the admin people want to hinder your outreach, but you can't help but feel that so often how your event goes is completely out of your hands. I don't know about you, but that sense of anxiety that maybe the church won't get built, or the feeling that the people who oppose it really are pretty intimidating, is probably the difficulty I find hardest of all the ones that we've looked at in Haggai. And its effects can be devastating for our temple building work. We can be demoralized as we start to think that we're somehow destined to fail. And even if we don't give up entirely, it can lead us to downsize our ambitions as we start to self-censor in our evangelism. Haggai's message to Zerubbabel speaks directly to those sorts of anxieties. As we listen in, what Haggai's going to tell us should turn our struggles in this area upside down. And he starts with our first point today, which is on your handout if you're following along. Haggai says that the great shake-up will topple every other kingdom. The great shake-up will topple every other kingdom. Haggai's message to Zerubbabel starts with news of an impending seismic shift. I am about to shake the heavens and the earth. God is planning a shake-up of the whole of creation. It's an image of sudden, unexpected, unstoppable, forceful upheaval of the whole of creation. Personally, I've only actually ever experienced an earthquake once. It was while I was at university in Durham, and it was a tiny one. 10 seconds or so of low-pitched vibration, and then gone. Actually, my roommate from back then was at church this morning, and he was asleep in the next room. I'm pretty certain it did not wake him up. But I remember feeling at the time that it was a situation over which I had no control. I knew it was unlikely in Durham, of all places, but I couldn't help realizing that if the shaking got more violent, there'd be nothing I could do to stop it. And God says that he's going to shake the whole of creation like that. And this is clearly not just a normal earthquake. Here it's not just the earth that's shaken, did you see, but the heavens and the earth, the whole creation is going to be shaken to its foundations. Zerubbabel actually already knows this. And you will too if you were here a couple of weeks ago. God had already talked about the great shake-up in Haggai's second message, which came about 2 months before this one. He said at that time that at the great shake-up, the temple would reach its glorious completion as all the riches of all the kingdoms of all the world poured in to beautify it. And today, Haggai is adding another detail, one that speaks directly into Zerubbabel's anxieties. He's saying that the other effect of the great shake-up is to topple every other kingdom on earth. Verse 22 couldn't make it any clearer, really, could it? He essentially says the same thing 4 times over. I'm about to overthrow the throne of kingdoms. I'm about to destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the nations and overthrow the chariots and their riders. And the horses and their riders shall go down, every one by the sword of his brother. Every kingdom is going to be toppled in the great shake-up. Their power, their authority, their strength, all the military might which gives them clout, it's all suddenly going to be toppled in a day of chaos and confusion. One day they might look invincible, but the next, suddenly, unexpectedly, unstoppably, forcefully overthrown. As Zerubbabel thinks about the emperor considering whether to allow continual temple construction, he must have been astonished to hear this news. Because if anyone in human history has seemed unshakable, it must be the Emperor Darius. Actually, he's often called Darius the Great. There should be a picture of him behind us. His name pops up 3 times in the book of Haggai because in Haggai's day, you told the date by how long he'd been in power. And chances are that the Achaemenid Persian Empire that he ruled over is one of the greatest empires that you've never really heard of. We're not really told anything about it at school, are we? But I looked it up this week, and it was bigger than the Roman Empire at its greatest extent. Its northeastern provinces were in modern-day India. Its southwestern provinces were in Sudan. And Darius ruled over more land than any Persian emperor before or after. Historians estimate that at least 44% of the world's population lived under Darius's rule. Small wonder then that his official title was Shah and Shah, the King of Kings. It must have been so hard for Zerubbabel to imagine such a colossal empire being brushed aside like this. But if he took it to heart, one thing would be clear. But when it came to his anxieties about building the temple, amazing though it might seem, Darius really wasn't worth worrying about. And certainly the mere governors who were opposing him weren't. Perhaps they would be inconvenient. Perhaps they'd throw up roadblocks that would stall the temple building, but it's clear they could never finally stop it. With the great shake-up on the horizon, it's obvious that they just don't have that kind of power. God's temple will be built, and nothing they can do will ever stop it. And maybe as we think about the things we fear might throw off the temple building project, we also feel the same sense of disbelief that Zerubbabel would have had. After all, our culture is built around the idea of progress, this story that we were primitive in the past, and we've been getting more and more advanced ever since. And that's a story that generally puts Christianity in the past. It says that lives devoted to building God's temple belong in the medieval world. It's no way for modern people to live. And that story has its own built-in sense of inevitability, doesn't it? Politicians talk about being on the wrong side of history because people assume that history is only going in one direction. And it can be tempting to feel powerless to resist. I understand that. I get that. That's often how I feel about things. But Haggai is telling us that our culture's sense of inevitability is misplaced. No country or government, no society or ideology is strong enough to stop the building of God's temple. We have no need to be anxious. It's going to get built. I can't tell you a time or a date, but when the great shake-up comes, every authority structure or institution or organization that stands in the way of the temple's completion will collapse forever. And if that's true of the big picture story that dominates our culture, how much more is it the case with the day-to-day roadblocks that we experience in our lives? Perhaps your head teacher will be able to block your plans for a CU, but she'll never be able to stop the temple being built. So don't lose heart. Keep going and look for other opportunities to get on with the building work. Pray for those kids and also for opportunities to talk in the staff room. And have confidence that in the great shake-up, nothing's going to stand in the way of the temple's completion. And it's the same with your uni admin. You might feel like, deliberately or accidentally, they have the power to ruin your event. And sometimes the hoops that they make societies jump through might be a real inconvenience to the work of building up the church on campus. But at worst, it's only a minor setback to the temple building project as a whole. We can keep plugging away, knowing that nothing they do will ultimately hold back the growth of the church or last beyond the great shake-up. Now, if all this seems surprising to Zerubbabel, then what comes next would have made him fall off his chair with astonishment. Because the great shake-up will topple every other kingdom, and, this is our second point, it will also establish the signet ring king. The great shake-up will topple every other kingdom and establish the signet ring king. Now, I know a lot of us won't be familiar with signet rings, and I'm afraid I'm not nearly posh enough to own one, but luckily our very own Rob Mullock is, and he was kind enough to lend me his for this Sunday. I don't really dare pass it around, it's a family heirloom, but there should be a picture on the screen. The idea is that back in the day, when you wanted to show that a document really came from you and had your stamp of approval, you would pour out a little bit of molten wax onto it and press the ring in to leave behind whatever picture you'd chosen as your symbol. This one's quite nice. It's got a bow in a fist and a little motto in Latin that says, "Only virtue is necessary." In days gone by, armed with this ring, I could start writing documents with the full authority of Rob Mullock. I've tried not to let the power go to my head as I've considered all the rotors I could edit and such like, but hopefully you understand then that signet rings are very valuable objects, at least the right signet rings are. And did you see what God promises Zerubbabel in verse 23? "On that day, declares the Lord of hosts, I will take you, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, declares the Lord, and make you like a signet ring," or the footnote says more simply, "make you the signet ring, for I have chosen you, declares the Lord of hosts." As the great shake-up topples every other king around him, Zerubbabel is going to become God's signet ring. He's going to become the living sign of God's authority and approval in the world. What Zerubbabel orders will have God's authority behind it. What Zerubbabel says is right, God will back up. This is an astonishing turn of events for Zerubbabel. He's not a king at all at this stage. He's just the governor of a tiny little province on the edge of this massive empire. If he'd wanted to, the emperor could have given him the sack without anyone batting an eyelid. I wish I could show you a picture of him like I did for Darius, but as far as we know, nobody ever drew him. He just wasn't that important. And now, God is saying that in time, Zerubbabel will be his seal of authority in the world. And this would have meant even more for him because of his family background. You remember I mentioned at the start that Zerubbabel's grandfather had been the king of Judah. Well, you might have thought that that stood in his favor when it came to stuff like this, but listen to what God says about Zerubbabel's grandfather in Jeremiah 22. As I live, declares the Lord, though Kenaiah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were the signet ring on my right hand, yet I would tear you off and give you into the hand of those who seek your life. Zerubbabel's grandfather had been a terrible king. Kenaiah, or he's also sometimes called Jeconiah in the Bible, was the king when the people were sent into exile. God has said to him, directly, personally, even if you were my signet ring, I'd tear you off and throw you away. Zerubbabel will have lived his entire life in the shadow of those words. Even his name means child of Babylon. He was born an exile. But now he's being talked about as God's servant, his chosen one, his signet ring. And if this is true, it's obvious that Zerubbabel doesn't need to worry about whether the temple will finally get completed. If he's going to be the signet ring king, Darius or Tatanai or anyone else just doesn't have the authority to stop him from building the temple. God has set his seal on the project. It will get done. If Zerubbabel is the signet ring king, then of course the project is going to be completed. He's got the power. He can carry it through to the end. Zerubbabel can breathe a sigh of relief. God says that with him at the helm, the temple building project can't fail. Now, it's possible that you're thinking, whoa there, this is quite big stuff for a Bible character that, frankly, I've never really heard of. And certainly, people at the time would not have noticed Zerubbabel's family fortunes improving very much. In fact, we're not really sure how it happens, but Zerubbabel's family is actually worse off before too long. Eventually, they're reduced to manual labor. They take up carpentry for a living. But Zerubbabel fathered a son called Abiud. And Matthew chapter 1 tells us that Abiud fathered a son called Eliakim, who fathered Azor, who fathered Zadok, who fathered Akim, who fathered Eliud, who fathered Eleazar, who fathered Matan, who fathered Jacob, who fathered Joseph, whose wife gave birth to a little boy, Jesus. And Jesus is the true signet ring king. He's the one who said, do you remember it was our theme verse 3 weeks ago, I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. He's the one that rose from the dead and said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples. Jesus is the only one who can see the process of constructing this massive temple to completion. As he reigns from heaven, he directs the advance of his kingdom, gathering in the living stones for the temple from the four corners of the earth, until he comes to remake the earth as the final, complete dwelling place of God with man. So as we struggle with our anxieties about whether the temple building project will fail, we need to look to the man who's running it. Of course it would fail if any one of us were in charge. It's just so massive a project. The problems are so many. The opposition is so great. But it's being run by the signet ring king, the one who carries all of God's authority to bring this project to glorious completion. The one to whom every knee will bow and every tongue confess at the great shake-up on the last day. No wonder they call him the King of Kings. And when you compare him to Jesus, the signet ring king, your HR manager clearly lacks the authority to make you stop with your service building God's temple in your office. Sure, it might be wise to be careful about the way that you speak. Perhaps you do need to work on your tone. Maybe it's worth reflecting on the relationships you have with your colleagues. But your Jesus chat shows that you're standing with the signet ring king. It's on his orders that we look to be his ambassadors. So whatever adjustments we might make, there's no question of us stopping altogether. This is also why we at Euston Church and other churches don't hesitate to send mission partners to areas where it's dangerous or even illegal to work in building the church. Of course, we respect the government in those countries because God commands us to do so. But they just don't have the authority to forbid God's temple from being built. The signet ring king himself has told us to get building. Who could tell us to stop? Now, as it happens, in 520 BC, Darius got back to Zerubbabel, saying that he was happy for him to keep building the temple. In fact, he even ordered Tatanai to take money from the imperial treasuries to help pay for it. It must have been a weight off Zerubbabel's mind, not to mention an interesting conversation topic the next time he was at a reception with the other local governors. But given what Haggai has said, Zerubbabel would have known that, ultimately, the success or failure of the temple building project doesn't rest with Darius, the so-called King of Kings, because even he would lose his empire eventually. While Zerubbabel's heir, Jesus, the real King of Kings, goes from strength to strength. As we grapple with the same anxieties Zerubbabel faced, will we be able to look away from the powers that we think might derail our efforts and give thanks that no one will stop the signet ring king?